We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm so happy to be joined by the one and only Yoram Hazony. He's the chairman of the Edmund Burke Foundation. He's an award-winning political theorist. He's also author of the new book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. Yoram, thank you so much for joining the show.
Emily, it's great to see you.
Likewise. And this book, a lot of people, I think the last time you were on the show was over nationalism, the virtues of nationalism, your last book. You took that on a couple of years back. Why is it that you wanted to do sort of this sweeping history of Western conservatism at this particular moment?
Well, the book has four parts. It has, it has, as you say, this history that, you know, goes back centuries and centuries. I think it's important for people to see some perspective, so that, you know, you don't too many people kind of think of conservatism as like this post World War II thing, and an awful lot of very educated people say things like, you know, Edmund Burke was the founder of conservatism, which really makes no sense at all, because he was defending this tradition that he thought was hundreds of years old. And I thought it was really worth conservatives knowing their own background. The second section of the book has a lot of new political theory, which is mostly answering the question, what would conservatism look like if we actually really wanted to conserve things and transmit them forward through the generations. There's a current affairs section, and there's a personal section about me and my wife, which she approved.
It's really important to specify that. So you already touched on two different areas that I wanted to ask about, and I'll start with Edmund Burke in particular, because of course you are the chairman of the great Edmund Burke Foundation. You write about the English sort of thought tradition quite a bit, especially in that first section that you mentioned. What did America take from Burke? And then what had influenced him, I guess? What did he think he was conserving?
Okay, I'll do that in the reverse order. First of all, yeah, Burke is conserving the great common law constitutional tradition of England, and that includes a government that has divided powers. So a lot of this will sound familiar. There's a unitary executive vested in one person. There's a bicameral legislature, and which is responsible for taxation and for legislation. There's a executive veto. There's a jury trial, which in those days was considered to be, you know, a part of the democratic participation in the English Constitution. Is that when people go on trial, they're tried by, you know, common people, not by some noble or something. And there's lots more. I mean, most of the rights in the American Bill of Rights appear in English constitutional documents like the Petition of Rights and the English Bill of Rights, which Burke is defending. He's defending that entire system. And going back many centuries, and that system is, to a very large extent, what the American Federalists, who were kind of like the founding National Conservative Party in America, when they gathered and wrote the Constitution of 1787, that was after 11 years of disintegration and mismanagement and failure on the part of the original American Constitution, the Articles of the Confederation, and the group that Washington led, Washington, Jay, Adams, Hamilton, that group, what they wanted to see was a restoration of something as close as possible to the traditional English Constitution. And in fact, Adams wrote a book that came out, the first volume came out in 1787, defending the American Constitution, and where he explicitly said the English Constitution is the best that history has ever had. And what's great about the American constitutions, he's thinking also about the state constitutions, is how much they take from England. So I think, I mean, Americans have all sorts of reasons to emphasize the break with England. But I think that if you're, if you want to understand what really happened at the American founding, the American Constitution is a restoration of much of the English Constitution.
Where does Jefferson come into this picture? You contrast the Declaration with the Constitution itself, and obviously the tension between the Burkean wing and the Jeffersonian, Lockean wing is understood by many people. But in the context of the argument you are making, where does Jefferson sort of come into the picture?
Well, Jefferson is really the child of the rationalist Enlightenment. He's you know, like Tom Paine, he's a child of that moment, and he really doesn't, you know, I mean, it's kind of like this famous thing that he doesn't actually think America needs a constitution, you know, much less inheriting one from England. He thinks that the that reason is good enough, and that Americans should meet every 20 years to, you know, to write a new constitution for the next 20 years. It's a famous point of view. It's had a tremendous influence in American history, but it is kind of the opposing point of view. I should also say that Jefferson is the most eloquent spokesman for the idea that that government just, you know, that you should just have as little government as possible, and it should stay out of the way, and you know, other than keeping people from pounding, you know, from punching at one another or killing one another, then government really isn't needed. So he's the source of that whole view, you know, which has lots of adherence today on the political right, you know, a lot of the reason for my going into this is that I want people to see that Jefferson's view is not the only American view, that there's a lot of important founders who thought differently.
Yeah, I think that was taken for granted in the conservative movement for years, and you write about this in your section on fusionism, but maybe just from a 30,000 foot view, why do you think it is that the Jeffersonian maybe wing or the Jeffersonian take became so central to the American conservative movement to the point where people almost forget that there were, I guess, competing visions?
Yeah, the story is complicated because Jefferson becomes kind of like a huge hero in the American understanding during the Roosevelt years, and it's Roosevelt and his circle were interested in building up a founder who could be their founder. It's a little bit ironic that Jefferson then ends up being, you know, the hero of so many people on the right. But the construction of the Jefferson Memorial and the overall cult of Jefferson, which its purpose was to deconservatize American history, because you know, prior to the Roosevelt years, the Republican Party was dominant, you know, overwhelmingly dominant since the time of Lincoln, and the way that sort of the standard way America was founded by George Washington. He was the founder of, he and his partners, you know, they founded the country, and then Lincoln, who's another nationalist Republican, was the one who, you know, who saved the country, That sort of framework was very uncomfortable for the sort of more socialist leaning, left leaning Roosevelt, who wanted to add lots and lots and lots of new economic rights to the Bill of Rights. And so he's really the one who created it. He created this idea that that we could really see Jefferson as the real founder of the United States instead of Washington. So it's really weird that, given that it's Roosevelt who did that, so why is he then adopted by, you know, people of the right? Not sure.
It's a good question. All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort, and that's why I love my X-Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, Chair, FederalistCom, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. And in Justice Alito's leaked opinion in the Dobbs case, there was some kerfuffle on the left because he cited Cook and he cited common law a couple of times. And of course, it was in the context of a very specific and narrow argument about whether something is deeply embedded in history and should qualify as, you know, a precedent, basically. Or a right that should be read into the 14th Amendment. But what is it? The left was upset because they say we should have nothing to do with common law. We must not celebrate the common law. It was, you know, all of the familiar complaints soaked in racism and bigotry and misogyny. But in the time that the Constitution is being drafted and America is being founded, and all sorts of changes are happening in Europe and England and France, what did the common law, to what level was the common law such an important foundation for later freedoms and freedoms that we enjoy and maybe struggle with now?
Well, I recommend a short book called In Praise of the Laws of England, which is sort of, it's incredible. There's a new edition of it out with Cambridge, where they cleaned up the spelling. So it's really, really easy to read. It's short and it's easy to read. This is a book by one of the most important common lawyers in English history, John Fortescue. And it was, believe it or not, it was written in the 1470s. And you know, it's like written 500 years ago, and you can read it today. It's crystal clear, and it sounds so much like the American Constitution that we know. I mean, almost everything that I named before, the characteristics of the English Constitution, are described and explained and defended by Fortescue, in addition to, you know, other ideas that are familiar to us, like the jury trial is better than, you know, the trials in Europe, where they use Roman law and they're allowed to torture people. And Fortescue makes the connection between private property and prosperity. He says the reason that we're so prosperous, that we're so well fed and successful in England, is because the common law doesn't allow the king to set foot in the house of the lowliest a farmer without his permission, much less to take anything out of the house. So the common law tradition is the tradition that gave us the most of the provisions of the American Constitution, and concepts like the separation of powers, checks and balances. Those are common law concepts that you read in Fortescue already in the 1470s when he's explaining, why is the English Constitution the freest constitution in the world? Why is it the best constitution in the world? So those kinds of books just aren't read today. And I think that the reason is because part of this same myth of, America was founded by reason rather than out of tradition. Part of this same myth is the unbelievable brilliance of the towering genius of the people who created America, more or less from nothing, in 1776, and aside from being just ahistorical. I think that myth does a great disservice to the American founders who understood themselves as traditionalists. I mean, they were, and I'm not talking about Jefferson again, I'm talking about the Federalist Party, but they were all trained, many of them were lawyers, and as lawyers, they learned, out of Cook and out of Blackstone. They study. I mean, they had Fortescue on their shelves. So today there's kind of this, everything began ex nihilo in 1776. But it isn't historically correct, and much more important, it gives us the wrong example instead of giving us an example of people who revered the traditions and were repairing them and improving them. It gives us an example of people who supposedly you just couldn't care about tradition at all and just thought for themselves, and all we need to do is the same thing.
For most of human existence, our species lived under really similar conditions, and those conditions start changing a lot, actually, around the time that Fortescue is writing, of course, before that as well, but then into the American founding, into the Cold War, certainly with the rise of and the relevance of nuclear technology. This is a huge question, of course, but at the same time, it's, when people think of the common sense pamphlets being, delivered all over, that isn't in itself something that wouldn't have been possible not too long, at least in the scope of history, before Thomas Paine did it. So how do you think technology shaped both the left and the right in, Marx reads like the Unabomber in some ways, the Communist Manifesto. So how are these things being shaped, or these trends that you write about being shaped by changes just in human capability?
That's a really hard question. I'm not sure that I have a good answer. I'm absolutely certain that that having everybody glued to iPhones, and especially to children, all day long, that it really is doing a lot of harm. Although it's difficult to pin it down. It's difficult to prove it, and it's difficult to know what to do about it. But I think the place to start this discussion about technology is actually with what has not changed, because it's too easy to say technology just completely changes the way things work. And like I say, I'm open to it, but I think we should begin with. And that's what I do in this book on conservatism, is that we should begin with what has not changed, which is that all human societies, whether they are ancient or medieval or early modern or hyper modern with us today, They're all based on this characteristic of human beings, which as far as we can tell, really is universal. Human beings are sticky. They like to form groups. They do it almost instantaneously. Like, you know, put a bunch of kids, give them a task, or let them compete in something. They almost instantly start to form hierarchies in terms of, you know, who's the leader and who's not, who's the best, who's contributing the most, and these little hierarchies are competitive, and they become rivals of other little hierarchies. This happens everywhere. This is just what it is to be human, and a lot of what I do in this book is to go into the implications for our politics of understanding this. For example, the fact that that human hierarchies, natural human hierarchies, are based on honor. Honor meaning when you say, oh, you know, Jimmy's the best, you know, the best player on the team. When you say that, you're honoring him, and you build him up in other people's eyes, and the same thing true happens in the family. If a husband honors his wife, then she's built up in the eyes of the children, and she has they have more respect for her because of it. And if the president of the United States honors somebody by praising him, then everybody in the country, you know, to a certain degree, begins to take that person more seriously. And that's a foundation that when you come to look at something like Twitter and say, you know, how much has it changed our behavior? Well, in a certain way, it's changed our behavior because we're handing out likes and insults 24 hours a day. But at the same time, I mean, the basis of it is the way human beings have always been and will be for the foreseeable future. And the most important thing about this, I think, for America right now, is that that honor is the glue that holds societies together. It's the glue that keeps. If you want to know what allows a marriage to last, to endure the incredible hardships that every couple goes through, and challenges, what allows it to endure is exactly the honor that husbands and wives give to one another. And what causes families to fall apart is when that honor isn't given and people start to feel like they're insulted and unappreciated, and then they start interpreting everything, you know, in a negative light, and things go south really quickly. That's the same thing. The same thing is true for countries. Look at America right now. America is a dissolving country because the leadership of the different tribes and parties have no interest whatsoever in encouraging mutual loyalty amongst themselves for the sake of the national interest or the common good. These are very, very basic things that, you know, they might be sped up by technology or enhanced by technology, but they're fundamental. And our big problem, I think, is that when we study politics, when we think about politics, we don't study these basics of the nature of human societies and how they work. And then it becomes really easy to say, oh, you know, this is because of, you know, cell phones or something.
Yeah, it reminds me, Camille Paglia for like 30 years has been saying that if you want to have women's studies departments, there should be a biology class that's mandatory for you to get a women's studies degree. That turned out to be prescient. A lot of the thinkers of previous eras had bitter disputes amongst themselves. And we think of that sort of when we talk about the early era of American journalism in America, American news writing. But how did that, I think, common, the sense of a common good and the exchange of honor between a lot of these thinkers change their, why were their disputes different? You know, were they rooted in something that our disputes today are not rooted in, like a shared sense or a consensus on what the common good is?
Well, look, if you read, you know, for example, Chernow's biography of Hamilton, which it discusses a lot of these of the bitter party disputes of, you know, of the early Republic. And I think in a lot of ways that reminds us of today. I mean, there was deep suspicion and hatred, among the camps. Gertrude Himmelfarb once told, you know, me and some friends that that the Constitution, the best sign of divine providence was that Jefferson was in Europe when the Constitution was being written, because otherwise it never would have been written. And that might be a realistic assessment. So so I don't want to, like, you know, make it like, you know, everything in the past is rosy. There were there was tremendous bitterness during the American founding, the American Civil War. My guess is, I don't feel like this is something I know enough about, but my guess is that that the Civil War launched a pursuit of unity that that was still resonating in American politics in the 1960s and the 1980s. You know, very challenging times when you look at Lincoln and Grant after the Civil War, at the end of the Civil War, their decision not to try Southerners for treason. You know, I mean, they could have just taken the whole leadership and hung them all and said that that they were treasonous, but they decided to pardon them. And I think that this set a precedent for what needs to be done for the sake of national unity. And I'm sure a lot of people, you know, will criticize that decision. And, you know, there might be good reasons for it, but when you look at, when you watch the Nixon Kennedy debates, you know, from 1960, or the Reagan Carter debates from 1980, I think both sides show that kind of graciousness in conducting the debate. Now, they may really detest each other, and they may really think that, you know, the other side, you know, winning would be a disaster. I assume they did, but that's not what comes across on the screen. What comes across on the screen is this kind of friendly contest where, you know, if there, the, you know, the, there might be little jibes that are kind of hidden, but the general feeling that you get is, you know, we're on the same side here, and you know, if my opponent were to win the election, then, you know, we'll be the loyal opposition. We'll help them govern, and we'll win the next time. You know, watching those today from the perspective of you know, two consecutive elections in which huge proportion of the country thinks the election was stolen, and neither side will ever compliment the other, you know, because they're basically accusing them of treachery all the time. My guess is that that long willingness to give honor to and legitimacy to the other side, that it's in part the heritage of the Civil War.
That's fascinating. I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set regularly $109.99 for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza Dream Sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Obviously you're right about the Cold War, and the what we think about as modern conservatism is forged into this, I guess, fusionist coalition in reaction to the Cold War, in reaction to what we see as the rise of communism, particularly in Europe. But I think Senator McCarthy would say also here at home. And I'm wondering, Yoram, what they got wrong, or what that did, or what the sort of fusionist coalition, in what ways did that harm the broader conservative coalition as it became the consensus idea of what the right was in America?
Well, before I say what they did wrong, let me just say that they were extremely successful. This coalition of anti-Marxist liberals and conservatives that Buckley brought together in the 50s and 60s, they were extremely successful in doing the main things that they wanted to get done, which was, as you said, to defeat communism abroad and to roll back socialism at home, and they won those battles. They succeeded in providing sort of the ideas framework for the Reagan and Thatcher years and for the defeat of communism and the defeat of socialism for a generation. So it's a very, very successful movement. We have to understand that before we start criticizing it. But they didn't get everything right. And if today we need to ask questions, you know, like I think a lot of the young people are constantly saying versions of, you know, what are you talking about conservatism? What do you conserve? You haven't conserved anything. You know, there's no conservation going on. And I think that point is crucial. I think it's crucial that we directly address the young people who are skeptical of the inheritance of the conservative movement, because the question they're asking is right. You can see that even as the United States was defeating communism, that the things that had held together America as a nation, its traditions and its sense of common purpose, and its religiosity and its belief in its inherited Anglo-American constitutional framework, all of these things were decaying during the same time that, you know, conservatism was supposedly winning, and you can see it clearly in right after, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, right after that, Thatcher is removed by her own party from power in 1990 because she's opposing submerging independent Britain into like a federal Europe. And as soon as Ronald Reagan was gone, George H.W. Bush starts talking about, you know, the New World Order. There's nothing conservative about this new world order. It's this fantasy of imposing a worldwide liberalism by force if necessary on the entire planet. It's, I mean, just this crazy stuff. The same sort of idea that was removing all the borders in Europe under the Treaty of Maastricht. The Americans have it too, and I think it's really important to ask, where did conservatism go? Like, where did the tradition of national independence that founded these nations, like, where did it go? Where did the tradition of Christian religion and the biblical framework for moral life, where did it go? And I think the answer is in significant part that all of those things were privatized by the fusionists, that their strategy in the 1960s was, how are we going to defeat communism and socialism? And their answer was, we're going to stress the rights of the individual and the freedoms that are owed to the individual and the invisible hand that's going to make everything good if we emphasize the individual. And as far as other things, transmitting virtue, morals, religion, inheritance to the next generation, that was privatized. It was like assigned to the family. It was assigned to a couple of hours a week in church. At the same time, what was happening was that Bible was banned from schools and God was banned from the schools, and the public culture became one of liberalism, removing all restraints, from on pornography, on abortion, traditional constraints on divorce or the kind of family life that is considered legitimate. Constraints are being removed everywhere in the name of liberalism. And the conservative movement helped that by saying, our public view is about individual freedom. It's only in private that we emphasize virtue. So I think that was a tragic mistake that did a lot of harm. And as we're rethinking the conservative movement now, I mean, this is what I try to do in this new book, is to take this question seriously. What would it have to look like if we were actually going to conserve anything? What would it have to look like? And you get a very, very different answer from if you start with individual freedoms as an absolute and say, that's the only thing that matters.
Hmm. You connect this history and theory in the book, as you mentioned earlier, to your own personal experience. Tell us about that and why you decided to fold that into this book.
I decided to fold into the book because I felt like the book is making a lot of demands. It makes a lot of demands on its readers, right? And in other words, I'm not just saying in this book, look, here's an interesting historical observation or political theory observation. I'm actually saying that if you personally, the reader, if your life is a liberal life instead of a conservative life, if the life that you're leading is one that is pretty much freed of obligations, and you're putting off getting married and you're putting off having children, and you've moved very far away from your family and your community, you're not part of a congregation in an active sense, Christian or Jewish, but you're not actually part of the transmission of inherited values, ideals, texts, guardrails from one generation to the next. then even if you call yourself a conservative, you're not leading a conservative life. And you know, there's no surprise that no matter what you're saying, you influence everybody around you to be liberals, and with all of the implications of that. So I definitely felt like I'm telling people, you personally have to give up on your completely open horizons and undertake duties and discipline and take responsibilities for things that affect the public, that affect the nation. So if I'm saying that, you know, I just was, as I was writing this, I just kept thinking, you know, somebody's reading this and saying, God, you know, what a jerk this guy is. You know, like he just thinks, you know, he doesn't know me. And he's just sitting there telling me, like, you know, how I should lead my life. And everything he's saying is basically, you know, be more responsible. What does he mean by that? He means, you know, that I should be less free. Like, you know, I could just hear this, and it was somewhat reasonable. So I told my wife, I said, you know, I sort of feel like I owe them to like tell my story so that they can see, you know, what you and I did when, you know, when we were young, when we were in college, and we decided to lead a conservative life and our reasons. And so she agreed, and so I wrote this chapter, which is it talks in part about the fact that like many, many other people, Yael and I both came from broken families, and we knew from firsthand, you know, what divorce and social disintegration, what it's about and what it does. And then I tell some about the story of how and why we took up an Orthodox Jewish life, excuse me, and what it was like visiting religious communities, finding a different model for how life could be led, which was, you know, not a big political theory. It was realizing that that we didn't learn how to lead the kind of life that we thought would be a good life when we were kids, and we needed to learn it from older people who were experienced. And the institutional framework for doing that is the congregation, both in Christianity and Judaism. That's the place that, you know, people who are unsatisfied with the inheritance they got from their parents, the way that a congregation works is, there's always been kids who didn't get along so well with their parents. I mean, some kids are naturally loyalists, and some of them are naturally rebels. And the role that the congregation plays in helping young people grow up and become mature is that if you're not getting along with your parents, you can go to your grandparents, you can go to your aunts and uncles. And if not your aunts and uncles, then the minister or the priest or the rabbi, or the neighbors. There's many ways in which young people, or even older people, if they feel like they want to be part of the chain of transmission, and they feel like you know, like a lot of people do today, that they were robbed, they just didn't get good stuff from their elders. So the way the congregation works is to make available prominent role models that allow you to try to fix your life, and that's what Yael and I did. And you know, I don't think I would have written about that, you know, like 30 years ago, but you know, but today we've raised children. Now we're having we have three grandchildren born in the last couple of years, and we've been through a lot. I mean, we're still going through a lot. all family life is difficult. But I do think that we accomplished what we set out to do. I think that we did succeed in plugging into the chain of transmission, in making up to a large extent for the things that we didn't have growing up. And I think our children and grandchildren have a much better life because of the fact that we chose this conservative life.
And examples like that are certainly more difficult for young people to find. So I think it makes so much sense. And I hope a lot of young people read this book. Yoram Hazony, author of Conservatism, a Rediscovery, chairman of the Edmund Burke Foundation. Thank you so much for coming on Federalist Radio Hour.
Thank you, Emily. Great talking to you.
Absolutely. Well, you have been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.